Hey, everybody, and welcome to Pod Stallions, the official podcast of Plaid Stallions. As usual, I'm Brian, and to my left, several thousand miles, is Jason.
Hello, everybody.
I'm assuming you're to my left. I'm not really sure.
I always dress to the left, yes.
Don't hold me to that. So we're back, and we're going to talk about absolutely one of my favorite subjects, and I'm thinking it's Jason's as well because it's peppered into a lot of these episodes, and that is the seminal American animation company Filmation, which many of you, if you're a child of the 70s, it's hard to avoid their products, in fact, or their shows. And in fact, I think if you're a child of the 80s and 60s, it would be hard to avoid them. So.
Yeah, they really were this sort of well-known but unsung company, I think, that from, the 60s or early 70s had their own company going here in Hollywood.
All made in America.
All made in America, and they kept it that way as long as they possibly could, making, fun cartoons, silly cartoons, cartoon characters, superheroes, science fiction. Just all kinds of stuff that they thought kids would love. And it was done, it seems to have been done with a whole lot of love and care. And just the sheer number of names that worked over there, worked on projects that went on to work on bigger things and more animation and more live action stuff is kind of staggering, just what came out of that building.
Oh, absolutely. And to guide us through this episode, which is going to be part one because it's just too much to discuss in one show. I'm using the book Lou Scheimer, Creating the Filmation Generation, and that was written by the late Lou Scheimer with the assistant of Andy Mangels. And Andy is somebody I know you know well, Jason. And him he and I have exchanged emails before in the past. Andy is a very prolific writer, especially on fandom, like on comics and Filmation especially. I think he shows up in a lot of the documentaries, and he's something of a historian. And funny story is the other day there's a documentary on Netflix about Wonder. It's called Wonder Women, and it's about female superheroes.
Okay.
And within about 10 minutes of watching it, I was saying to myself, I wonder when Andy Mangels is going to pop into this thing. And I swear to God, he was in the next 2 minutes.
He really has made I don't know if it's prolific for him or not, but he really has become one of those guys that just it's obviously done with a lot of care
Yeah.
how much he loves these properties. I mean, I don't know him so much in the comic world. I mean, I know the booth that he has set up and sits at sometimes at Comic-Con and the, sort of GBLT undecided type stuff that's in there, those magazines. But he also, whenever it's a book on a superhero or a DVD that's come out about, Jason of Star Command, you can better believe that Andy Mangels is going to be the guy that's producing the extra features and asking the questions to the cast and sort of putting things in the right boxes because he knows these shows. I think he did the same thing for the Flash Gordon animated series,
Yeah.
for Black Star, for a bunch of others. Now, didn't Filmation also do the original Ghostbusters? Wasn't that their thing?
Yes, it was.
So he might have done something for that.
No, every Filmation DVD I think that I have features him, and I feel like we're better for it because he's done such a great job. And the real testament is this book, which I cannot recommend enough.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And it's what was your first, like, Filmation to me as a kid, it was the first cartoon company I recognized their style, and that spinning globe that said it had Lou Scheimer's name in it, and I think Norm Prescott, that I knew to be, oh my God, I like these cartoons.
Yeah, it was a sign of something to come. I think that the first sort of, I think the first time I noticed something that looked a little different than Saturday morning, animation or Saturday morning cartoons, which for the most part was, cartoon related, cartoon characters and stuff. I think we were all kind of desperate for more superheroes and space adventure and things like that. And I think the first thing I noticed was the Star Trek animated series and how suddenly animation didn't look like, you know, a cartoon, you know, Chicken Hawk. It looked like a man, you know, in a Starfleet uniform that was rotoscoped. We didn't know it at the time, but a lot of the running was rotoscoped.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that until adulthood, but I remember
it just looked
great.
More realistic, just the way they were moving, the way they were running and stuff. And of course, the effects with the ships and everything and what they could get away with. I think even as kids, we kind of thought that, well, you can get away with more in a cartoon. So they could get more ships and more different creatures and far off places. Unfortunately, couldn't get more voices because in Star Trek, they had to take Uhura and Sulu and Scotty, especially. Add on to all the voices that were in there.
It really shows that James Doohan had some voice talent.
Yeah, he had quite a range.
Yeah.
But it also it didn't creep me out exactly, but I also it was a little unsettling because I wasn't sure if it meant this was something under the show that was like a morning thing and the show still existed. Because I wasn't really sure what was going on with the show. I don't think I'd fully put it together. The show was off the air sort of thing.
Oh, I see.
So I might have thought, you know, that was a Saturday morning version of Star Trek, which I could be forgiven for thinking because as ABC and NBC would do throughout the years, they would do a Gilligan's Planet while a Gilligan's Island was running in syndication or a primetime movie was being done. They would do, you know, the Fonz with his dog, Cool, or whatever it was, while Happy Days was still running. They did loads of times where there were, you know, sitcoms that were running just fine. And to add to the metal, they, you know, made a cartoon out of it on Saturday morning. So
yeah, and they got pretty horrible too.
Yes. Yes, really horrible.
I seem to be blocking out memories of Laverne and Shirley in the army with a talking pig as their sergeant, but I'm trying to forget that.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Now, Filmation, according to this book, and I believe it is, they got their start with Superman. Mm. And in the 60s, Filmation did a lot with the DC characters. They did some Justice League shorts, Green Lantern, Aquaman. And of course, Batman. And Batman's my first memory of Filmation. It's one of my first memories of all time. I think I may have not even been 2 years old watching the Penguin steal a tank, and I really remembered that. But I don't know about you, but you know, you watch the Super Friends growing up in the 70s, and they were all kind of, you know, they all solved their problems with talking, and then. You know, I think the Justice League and the Super it was in a package, the old Filmation shows, and they would run on Saturdays and Sundays. And I used to have to go to my friend's house and watch them because I didn't get all the channels, you know, and I had that TV free summer thing going on. But those cartoons, because they were from the 60s, and I guess, you know, there was something done to end the violence on network Saturday morning programs when we were kids. They were so violent. You know, Superman just kicks the crap out of stuff. You know, I think Hawkman is forever shooting things. They were so amazing to me as a kid, you know?
Like shooting things with a gun? He was shooting things?
Yeah, he had like ray guns on his hands. There's much more violence in those 60s Filmation superhero cartoons than there was for the entirety of the 70s.
And those aren't the ones that are like made by, you know, those aren't the ones that sort of look like they're pasted together.
No, that you're thinking of the Marvel superheroes. Those are done by Grantray Lawrence.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We can get into them someday because they're all voiced by Canadians.
That's great because one of the things I wanted desperately in a cartoon like that was going to be an adult cartoon or like a, you know, an animated adventure in space or something was punches, you know, dodging punches, you know, getting in fights and stuff.
Yeah.
And when you start watching some of this stuff, well, I mean, Tarzan was the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Tarzan was a Filmation thing. And it was always these elaborate ways. Even as a kid, you figured out there was some elaborate way to like string someone up by their feet, or, you know, trip them with a rock, or, oh, they fell into the water or whatever, but never actually getting any fisticuffs, even though they've done horrible things to your jungle. And
I think Tarzan may have practiced like Aikido almost, where he just kind of flipped people, didn't he?
He did. He did some flipping. I don't know if he did any kicking, but he did some flipping.
Mm-hmm. And it had that taken place in the 60s, you would have just seen, you know, as they said, old chin music. You know, there would have been some punching, because even the Batman cartoons show that kind of that kind of violence. And
oh, interesting.
Yeah, and
things were changing.
They were. Well, there was a definite outcry of parents saying there's too much violence on Saturday morning shows. And that was not only the Filmation stuff, but at the time, Hanna-Barbera was full-on superheroes. And, you know, I'm pretty sure – I'm not the world's biggest Herculoids fan. I don't know if you are. But I think it's just the same plot every week.
Uh-huh.
You know, a spaceship comes down and the Herculoids fight it. You know, didn't seem to be a lot there.
I was going to say the Tarzan thing that was cool about that was you got the sense that these guys were whatever they were doing, they were taking it very seriously. Mm. They were trying to – I mean, I didn't necessarily think that there were, you know, a bunch of guys in suits and ties sitting in the back room of Filmation, you know, saying, hey, let's make this really interesting, you know. But you could tell that it just – you just would watch certain shows and they felt different. They didn't feel like or sound like, you know, the next type of show over.
Well, Lou Scheimer once, I got to meet him. He was available at San Diego Comic-Con, and he was a very personable and approachable guy. And I talked to him and his daughter, and I said, you know, I really loved the Tarzan show as a kid. And his daughter turned to me and said, oh, Dad loves Tarzan. So that really did shine through, I think, in the series, that this guy was a fan himself as a kid.
I think you get the sense with Tarzan and Flash Gordon that he really – these were some of the things that he grew up with and that he really wanted to take care of.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and Flash Gordon – I mean, Tarzan was like – I mean, I remember reading some of the books, even at that age, because my brother had all the books, and – they weren't impossible for a, you know, 7-8-year-old to get through, but you know they were kind of weird. But they, you know, the apes and the lions. I think, if I recall correctly, they all had their own language. Mm-hmm. They all spoke in the books. You never had that in any other incarnation of Tarzan, I don't think.
Well, most incarnations of Tarzan, they kind of followed that trope of me, Tarzan, you, Jane. Whereas in the books, Tarzan was a pretty intelligent dude.
Right. They very much made him out to be that in the cartoon. But, you know, when he spoke to gorillas, they spoke back.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was a really cool original idea to put back into that, is that Tarzan, that there was that gorilla world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't think anything of it. It just kind of worked.
Yeah, it did. And it's funny how you know, people, if they say you ask them about Tarzan, they'll say things about Cheetah and Me, Tarzan, You, Jane and all that. And but really, the stuff on the Filmation show was more book accurate than the Hollywood films. I mean, in Nakima, some of the plots, you know, having Tarzan going to the center of the earth or having Tarzan going to a valley of dinosaurs, that was all stuff Burroughs did.
Yeah, all the places he went in those books and stuff.
It's funny that Hollywood would limit Tarzan to just being this certain thing when actually he had a whole universe, you know?
Yeah, it could have been a matter of budget. It could have been a matter of here's what we can get away with on an animated cartoon to do with this character. The sad thing is that series is no longer or has never been available on DVD or VHS.
I've heard rumors it might be coming.
Boy, I wish it would.
Yeah, I can't remember if I dreamt that or if that's real, but there you go. Well, I was going to get back to chronologically because we could do a whole Tarzan show, I think. But the biggest hit I think Filmation had in the 60s was the Archies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that caused a huge revolution. I mean, they started selling – they had a top 10 hit based on that show with Sugar. And I, of course, remember the Archies very fondly. Have you ever seen the actor who did the voice of Archie?
No.
He looks like an old hillbilly.
Really?
Yeah. His name was Dallas McKinnon, and he's pictured in this book, and it's just a man with a great big white beard, which really, now I can't watch the show. I'm done.
He looked like that when he did the song?
Yeah, this is a vintage picture. Well, no, the song, I think, was done by someone else, and it was just one man doing all the voices.
Okay.
And I don't remember who that is, but I thought that's one of the things in this book that just makes me laugh. And as much as I liked the Archie cartoon as a kid, I bought a DVD for my kids on a road trip. I was in a gas station. I saw it there, and I was like, "Hey, cool!" And it didn't last an hour.
Wow.
Oh, the kids couldn't stand it. It hasn't aged very well. I think it was a lesser, like it wasn't the original series. It was like Archie's Jukebox or something like that, which I remember not liking either. I didn't know what I was getting. And
isn't the Archie comic now being known as like this real progressive comic with storylines and, minorities getting represented better and things like that?
Yeah, I always think Archie's a bit. They're doing that, and they're still very popular because they have that grocery store checkout popularity. But I find Archie isn't going to take any risks.
but Jughead will.
Yeah, well, no, what I mean by that is that they're adding more minorities, but they're doing it very safely and. It's good for them. I mean, the world's changing a bit, and Archie needs to change somewhat. I mean, they're not. It doesn't seem like they're changing the core of the characters, what the essence of the characters are, but updating them is, that's a spice of life. They're different from when I was a kid, but they were different from when my parents were kids. So, maybe that's key to their popularity. And my daughter reads an Archie Digest. That's probably. We have a bunch of Archie Digests in the house, and I think they're all older than my daughter. I think they're older than a lot of people, but she reads an Archie Digest with her cereal every morning. So,
it's still popular. Thing that sort of the hot water they got into with the monkeys, where when the monkeys started getting uptight about wanting to write and record their own material, and they were getting very uptight about songs being brought to them. Hits kind of, pre-made hits being brought to them and them just singing on them and stuff.
Yeah.
And they kept saying, "Hey, man, we can do more. We can do more."
Yeah, I think that's true.
And it's true that they could. They did do some stuff, but they kind of shot the golden horse in the foot, or whatever you want to call it. Because then, who am I thinking of? Who's the guy that created the Archies?
Don.
He had his own show.
Kirshner?
Night. Kirshner.
Yeah.
Don Kirshner comes along and says, "All right, screw these stupid kids. I'm going to create a band. I don't need them."
Well, that's what I was trying to, what I was going to segue into. The Archies created this band thing, and that concept went crazy, especially at Filmation. Now every show, whether you solved mysteries or you did anything, you had a musical interlude at the end.
Right.
And the next thing they did was the Hardy Boys. Now, I don't remember the Hardy Boys, but it was, exactly the same thing where they solve mysteries. And then there was a music video at the end. And just jumping back to Archie for a second, there was a filmmaker in Toronto that made this short that used to play all the time downtown. It was called Blue Peanuts. He had taken the peanuts and put scenes of Blue Velvet over top of them. So it's like Lucy talking, and I think Snoopy was Dennis Hopper's character, and at one time Snoopy's drinking a beer, and it says, like, "Pabst Blue Ribbon, man!" But the other part of Blue Peanuts was the Archies playing God Save the Queen.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I always loved that. So because that music video, it worked because they reused those music videos for everything, right?
That's funny.
So and then they did the Hardy Boys, and then they did I think the one that I'm most fond of from the early 70s is Groovy Ghoulies, who also had a band.
That's right, they did. They had the theme song too.
Yes, and it's a great theme song, and I forget who remade it on that. Do you have that Saturday Morning's Greatest Hits? It was released around 94, 95.
I do. I just don't remember
that record.
I don't remember. I remember Matthew Sweet doing Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, and Juliana Hatfield.
Tanya
Josie Donnelly. And the Pussycats.
One banana, two, but you know, the banana flips thing was like Tanya Donnelly or somebody.
Yeah, the Ramones cover Spider-Man. Ramones did
Spider-Man.
Wax did Speed Racer.
There was some good stuff on there.
It really was. It really was a good album. But whoever did the Groovy Ghoulies I still love that song. I love that version of it.
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Neither do I.
I don't remember. And it's one of those shows that I had a box set at one point.
Of the Ghoulies?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it had all kinds of extras, you know, with what's his name? Jess Harnell and your pal. You know, the guy, a big creature from the Black Lagoon collector.
Dan? Roebuck?
Yes, Dan Roebuck are both on this DVD doing the extras, and they do this, get the song together, and they do the archival stuff, and it's very well done and fun and everything.
You know what? I need to watch that because that's in my kids' DVDs, and I've completely – I don't know where that is now, but they love the Ghoulies.
The extra DVD, it's like all their stuff. I just never – I mean, I never – I watched it when it was on, and I have a huge fondness for the look of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much of its time, obviously. Very much feels like a mid-70s, early 70s, you know, jive kind of thing.
I love mock horror, so, I absolutely am a huge fan. And the thing I would love to track down but probably never will is that the merchandising for that show, there's actually these great little PVC figures made by Chemtoy that are gorgeous. And, you know, Chemtoy was hit or miss with their figures. Like, they did some DC comic figures that looked like a 8-year-old did them. And then they did these Groovy Ghoulies. And they did, which we'll get into later, Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids. And they're perfect. They look amazing. And unfortunately, those Chemtoy Groovy Ghoulies are really pricey. So unless I find a money tree or a baggie of them at Value Village, I might be out of luck.
They never did a proper line years later?
No, nobody's ever really picked that up again. I mean, there's been some cool – there was even a live-action Ghoulies special on TV. I think you can see that on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
It's Groovy Ghoulies Meet Daffy Duck, I believe. It was some TV special. It's really cool to watch now. But no, I don't think anyone's ever picked up the property and done proper figures of it. It's weird. Everybody knows what it is, but it seems a bit obscure now.
Well, didn't Filmation also do the Addams Family? Did that become a Filmation thing?
That was Hanna-Barbera.
Hanna-Barbera. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I don't know why that's not available on any sort of multimedia form. Cause I'd buy that in a heartbeat for myself.
Yeah. I remember that better actually.
Do you? No, I barely remember that one, but, It's one of those things that I would love to see again. And, you know, you're talking about something that's a little obscure. Did you know that Filmation did a Dick Tracy cartoon?
I think I did.
Now, it's not that one that's from the 60s where it's always like a cartoon dog or a racial stereotype going to fight crime. This one was actually like I think it was like Archie's Funnies or something where – you know, they took all these comic strip characters like Dick Tracy and the Cats and Jammer Kids and Nancy and Sluggo, and it ran for 1 year, and it was a straight Dick Tracy cartoon in the style of Filmation, and I'm dying to see it. And it was released on VHS when the Warren Beatty movie came out.
Mm.
And I remember I must
only know it from the book.
Yeah, because the more common one you can find is that terrible – well, I think it's terrible, the terrible 60s one. But
Jiu-Jitsu.
Jiu-Jitsu, yeah, that one, yeah. That is something I would love to see. And, of course, Fat Albert – I didn't know Fat Albert was from 72. Did you?
No.
It was always on.
It seemed to be on every Saturday morning that I grew up. It was on.
Fat Albert was my get out show. because it came on at like 11:30,
Uh-huh.
and my parents would be like, "You've been inside all day," you know, and that would be the kick me out of the house show. I
Yeah.
rarely got to see Fat Albert.
I never like loved it. I always thought it was funny. I loved the song. I loved the characters, but I'm not sure if I was like glued to watching it.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it was always there, and it's funny how you know kids, if you're a kid of the 70s, you know that show because it was always on. I liked it, but like I said, I rarely got to watch it. Funny story is we have a retro channel here, and they were playing Fat Albert a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking with my 2-year-old daughter down a street, and she's going, "Hey, hey, hey!" to everyone she sees.
That's very funny.
It was rather precious.
Slightly embarrassing, but very funny.
You know, I wouldn't say it was. You know, it's a cute little girl. It's not like I was doing it.
But you will.
I will when I lose my marbles, and that's coming up. then this is something else that Filmation did. I'm just flipping through the book. Is spinoffs of regular television shows. We were just talking about this, and the first one I could find was the Brady Kids. Do you remember this?
No.
Oh, I do. They did a series about the Brady Kids. And they added two pandas for some reason, because that makes it better. And they had these weird guest spots where they would have like Wonder Woman, Superman, and I think even like the Lone Ranger on it.
Two pandas.
Yeah, two pandas.
Because they were rich, they could afford having pandas domestically.
Yeah, the architects, they're
mm-hmm.
they're loaded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No, they had a maid and a mom who didn't work. I never quite got that.
Yeah, well, think about it.
No, I don't want to. you know, I forgot to mention one show, and I don't know if you're a fan of this. I didn't see it as a kid, but I found the Gold Key comic of it, and
yeah.
It looked like the coolest comic in the world, so I bought it, and it was a little bit disappointing. Was the Fantastic Voyage cartoon.
The animated version of the movie, right?
Yeah, well, it was based on the movie, except they had these new characters. And they're kind of classically designed Filmation characters, and they added this because they, you know, they wanted everyone to know that the show took place in the 60s. They added a Hindu mystic,
of course,
to the team named Dr. Guru.
It's a great name.
Yeah, this is a weird show. I think I got a DVD of it from a friend, and I started showing it to my kids, and my kids really dug it, but I. You know, I never grew up with it as a kid, and I wasn't as big a fan. But it's I think it only lasted 1 year. But it's kind of a neat little relic to that movie.
I love that Dr. Guru is
Dr. Guru. Yeah.
Not only is it his name, it's his vocation as well.
That's right. That's right. And it's not lazily thought up.
Not at all.
No. So, and then I think we were already talking about this, and we have brought it up before, but. The big thing they did in 1974 was Star Trek.
Yeah.
You know, way ahead of the curve, they brought the show back. Because really, I think the big wave of Star Trek's popularity happened around 1974, 1975, 1976. You know, so.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, I think about how quickly they jumped on that.
Yeah, they really like were
they
smart.
They really must have seen that train coming around the corner and really noticing the numbers and seeing how big this show not only was but was going to be. It got even bigger in 1974 and 1975 and decided to, you know, do something about it and make a show. I think it showed an amazing amount of foresight on their part to do that, to dive into that. Not only dive into it, but to then go and get, you know, similar music and all the designs and everything else.
And of the original writers.
The original writers and voice cast, which is wild. You know, like that's just isn't done.
Yeah.
You know, just isn't done.
Do you have the official DVDs of that?
I do.
Yeah? Are they good? Because I've been dying to buy them. I
They're good, and there's some nice extras in there too. And you know, as far as the writers are concerned and the Star Trek, you know, aficionados are concerned, they kind of they consider those stories to be within canon.
Do they really?
Universe, yeah.
See, my son, I tried to get him to watch the original series. He didn't like it. He's a fan of the J.J. Abrams movies, but his true Star Trek love comes from that Filmation series.
There's something about it.
Yeah, and so much so that when he found out that you had the license for Star Trek merchandise, he said, tell Jason to make a Mr. Eric's figure.
Oh, tell him, believe me, we have been thinking about it for a long time.
Oh, that's good to know, because he has always been fascinated with that character.
Yeah, it's a little tricky with the avenues that we have, the categories that we have.
Yeah.
But I've always wanted to do that.
Yeah, you would sell one to a child in Canada.
So, there's just so little Star Trek merchandise that's been done for the animated series. You could hold it in one hand.
Yeah, you know what? I always kind of get excited when I see something that's clearly based on that. I think there's a board game by Hasbro. There may be a painting set that uses the Filmation characters. There's a table. I think I've seen it shown on the site.
Yeah. A kid's table and chairs.
Kid's table and chairs that uses that imagery, but very little else. And maybe a t-shirt or two. Not a heck of a lot based on that show, because they would just all, you know, Paramount didn't differentiate the licenses at the time. And there's a lot of back and forth with Mego collectors on whether or not the action figure line is based on the cartoon or it's based on the series. I talked to, you know, Neil Cublin about it at length, and he was the R&D at Mego, and he was the guy who pitched Star Trek at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, we just got a bunch of pictures and stills from the show. That's what we were licensing. But if you look at the Mego Klingon doll, it's clearly the Filmation Klingon.
You know? Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, boy. It's spot on. So, you know, I think they mixed and matched. I think it's just based on Star Trek in general. But, you know, there was a couple of things where they got pictures from the Filmation style guide. I don't know exactly what, but, you know, I was told they just got a bunch of pictures and film reels and they just sent them off to Hong Kong to make figures.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. And also, Neil Cublin kind of made a comment of, have you ever really watched that show? It's really cheesy, you know, so... There wasn't a ton of reverence towards the line, and that's why their Mego Mugatu figure is dressed like he's going to a concert.
But were they trying to do sort of a hybrid of the animated and the live action series?
No, I just think they were trying to make toys.
Okay.
You know, they were just trying to make toyetic toys for children. You know, there's sometimes points where they're really show accurate, and then they just take everything off the rails and,
mm-hmm.
you know, make a character pop off the card a little bit. Like it's lots of primary colors. It's a lot of simplification.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So, but you know, the one thing I was just trying to take away from that is I will argue that the Klingon is definitely based on the Filmation series.
Yeah. You're probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah, you definitely see him in there.
Yeah. So, and then I guess some lesser hits that we can probably not talk about are Mission Magic. Were you a big Mission Magic fan?
Boy, was I ever.
Were
you? Only when I found out who Rick Springfield was.
Well, that's, you know what? I'm glad you knew that, because this was news to me. But yeah, this was like a vehicle for Rick Springfield, and that's all I got. I'm positive there were songs at the end of that one.
And his Australian accent. He uses his real Australian accent. I mean, again, Filmation became one of those things that you just would recognize.
Yeah.
You got the feel of it, and you knew that it was probably Filmation. Yeah, you'd catch the logo at the front.
But they had a tell. They had certain voice actors, a style, animation style, and then sort of like a formula. Like one of the things that their formula I see. Because they did My Favorite Martians, which was a spinoff of the 60s sitcom.
Yeah.
And they always add a mascot-y type character to the show. That was one of their early tells, and they would do that later with Batman by adding Batmite.
Yes.
Tarzan was the only one I can think of where they didn't really add, because Nakima was canon.
They did it with Flash Gordon.
Oh, boy, did they.
And it's interesting because Flash Gordon, to me, would be the next thing we talk about, is truly, I feel, the high watermark of what Filmation did. That first season is just about the best Saturday morning cartoon ever made, up to maybe, you know, Batman the Animated Series or something.
It's almost not a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, exactly. Johnny Quest is close, too, but that's, you know, go back to the 60s. But, I mean, for my childhood, that was a huge part of it, and seeing that every Saturday morning. And it just didn't feel like any other show out there. It just felt so adult and so well-designed and so well thought out. And it was also, you know, he insisted on making it, you know, by chapter.
Yeah.
Insisted on having it go out chapter by chapter, which kind of became his undoing because he wanted it to emulate the serials of the 30s and 40s and, you know, have, you know, chapter 12, The Perils of Mongo or whatever.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but did NBC show those out of order?
They showed them in order initially, but I think that they got uptight about repeating them. We're like, well, we got to repeat them in the exact same order. Like, well, what's that? How can we just, what if we, and they got uptight about that syndication and stuff. It was a hit. It was a moderate hit. It was definitely a flagship for NBC amongst the other characters. It was their version of like a Star Wars, you know, animated series. There were toys galore, all kinds of cool stuff. The design is just superb. I just think across the board, the design for all those characters, it doesn't get any better. It brings everything that's best about the characters' designs together in a streamlined way for animation, and it just works, and it's just I just adore that thing. And then of course they did a second season because of, you know, getting word back from the network that like, hey, you better bring in some boop a doop a doop a doop in here. And so they brought in this,
I'd like to read that memo.
Yeah. Not enough boop a doop a doop a boop a doo, you gotta bring it in. So they brought in a little pink fat little pink dragon that floated around everybody's heads and caused mischief, and our good pal Lou Scheimer did the voice for it. So
of course, I think he did the voice for almost all the impy characters.
Right.
And I guess that's, what are we going to call them? Impy characters? Because they never stop.
Wimpy characters.
Yeah, the little goofy Godzuki type characters that are meant to bring in the laughs.
And they keep coming and they keep coming. And I don't know if anybody sitting in a room with electrodes strapped to kids, you know, thumbs or something going, oh, really? They're really laughing at this. This is great. We got to have more of these. I never understood. They did it with Brave Star. They did it with He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. They've done it with everything throughout 70s and 80s animation. Bring in this boneheaded little, you know, homunculus that causes trouble and knocks stuff over and, you know, gets people into trouble. And
the top of Garbage Mountain would be Scrappy Doo.
Scrappy Doo.
Because there was absolutely no – the show was not broken.
No. He kept going and kept going and kept going. So people seemed to like him. I don't know why, but
– nobody liked him. I think –
why did he run for 3 or 4 years?
I don't know.
He was in every Scooby-Doo show. He was constantly on the – if he was really with us trying to solve mysteries, you would shove him in the glove box and lock it.
The mystery would be, what happened to Scrappy?
What happened to Scrappy? What's
that? Why do you have a shovel, Brian?
The mystery of the smell coming from the glove box.
Yes, that's right. Don't open that.
Don't open that. It might be Scrappy.
Sandwich in there. I wanted to get to the thing that really broke my brain in the early 70s was live action was becoming a real big thing in the early 70s. I think it was led by the charge of the Kraft brothers, who we'll get to in another show. But Shazam was, a full-color, half-an-hour superhero show that was just fantastic for me as a kid. I know I was really disappointed when I picked up a real DC Shazam comic book, and it wasn't the adventures of Billy and Mentor driving around in a Winnebago solving social problems.
Which today, let's be honest,
oh,
slightly suspicious.
Little strange.
Well, they would have been flagged immediately.
Well, it's a little odd, yeah. It's a different time. I will tell you this, though. When I retire, I am going to get a Winnebago, and I am going to put that logo on the front of it.
Are you going to find a...
This ends another chapter of Brian's sad plans.
I was going to say, are you going to find a ward to go traveling with?
No, I won't be doing that. It'll be my wife. But I will wear that safari jacket like Les Tremaine does.
Oh, Les
one of the treasures of my toy or my autograph collection, by the way, autograph promotional picture of Les Tremaine that says, nice. "Keep watching Shazam."
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I love it. And I was a huge fan of this show as a kid. Love the production values in it. You know, I love the transformation of Captain Marvel. I like the Elder sequences that are animated. But I will tell you, there's a real shift in Captain Marvel's.
Oh, yes.
The first guy that played Captain Marvel was a guy by the name of Jackson Bostwick, who's a pretty much a great personification of what the character looks like. Like if you were going to cast Captain Marvel, you really couldn't do better than this guy. He's kind of got that Fred McMurray look to him, but he's also a physically fit guy. I think he was a bit of a kung fu artist back in the day.
Yeah.
Now he leaves over some dispute, and it's carried out in detail in this book. And from what I understand, he's an extremely nice man. And he is replaced really quickly by an actor named John Davey. And John Davey was kind of like in the Fred Ward school of looks. You know, he looked like a tough guy. He looked like a bit of a cowboy. Mm-hmm. Big hands on the guy. Not in the greatest, like kind of a little past middle age.
Mm-hmm.
So that suit's no longer quite as flattering as Captain Marvel. You know, he looks better than I would in that suit. So I'm not going to go real far and insult the man. But it really is kind of like a, hey, what happened? Even when I was like seven, like, what happened to Captain Marvel?
What happened to Captain Marvel? Yeah. Did he go on vacation?
Yeah.
Where did he go?
Yeah.
Well, I have one little Bostwick story that maybe I shouldn't tell, but it's not a big deal. But, you know, Alex Ross sometimes, you know, eventually makes contact with some of these folks that were big for him as a kid growing up, or that he eventually paints a cover of a particular comic or something. And I think he had dinner with him once, or it went well, and a few phone calls here and there. And clearly the man has a very strong faith, Bostwick. Which is great. But Alex had done a couple of political pieces for the cover of the Village Voice.
Oh,
one of which was
– former employer of mine as well.
One of which was George W. Bush taking his mouth off of Lady Liberty's neck, leaving two holes in her neck.
Oh, so he's like – he's a vampire.
Yeah, and he's got teeth and blood coming down his chin. It's a – amazing image. Cause
I'm going to say that was around 2002-ish.
It says everything in one quick image.
Yeah.
And it wasn't long after that Mr. Bostwick kind of sent him certain notes saying, I think we're done being friends kind of thing. And how could you do something like that? It's very interesting.
Strong convictions. I met him in a hotel lobby once, and he was really –
probably should keep it that way.
Gentlemanly fellow. I quite enjoyed it. And, you know, there's always that risk of, like, I've worried about meeting iconic people ever since I met David Prowse that one time, and he was kind of surly. I kind of get a little afraid when I want to get someone's autograph. You know, it's a little bit leery, and I've been lucky. You know, I think the last celebrity autograph I got was Gil Gerard.
And oh, yeah, he was nice.
Couldn't have been nicer.
He was nice.
Wonderful man.
Dirk Benedict was nice. Aaron Gray was nice. Mike Mignola was a douche.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a douche.
I like that. I like that guy's art.
I do, too. But he was a D-bag.
Yeah. Well, everybody – you know what? Also, everybody has their days, right?
Not me, pal.
No, you're on all the time, are you?
Come up to me any time of the day. I'll give you an autograph.
I'm forever giving everyone the finger.
I'm not giving the finger. I'm giving out free autographs.
And then, yeah, film. You know, going back to TV spinoffs, Filmation does Gilligan's Island, like we were talking about, the New Adventures of Gilligan.
Gilligan's Planet, right?
No, the New Adventures of Gilligan.
Oh.
Gilligan's Planet was an 80s thing, and they added, do you remember the name of their imp?
Dipshit.
Booper.
Close. Dipshit would have been better.
Well, Dipshit, I think, is the technical term, but Booper, Booper? Was the name. Booper.
And didn't the Fonz have a dog called, like, Mr. Cool?
Yeah, that was a Hanna-Barbera one, but, you know, they were very closely copied.
Oh, okay,
Filmation style.
Because then there was the Spider-Man and his amazing friends. And
Ms. Lion.
So he was Mr. Cool and she was Ms. Lion.
We're just basically going over stuff we hate right now.
We could do an entire episode on all the stuff we hate from our childhoods, starting with these imps.
And
they're having no purpose in the shows whatsoever.
Well, to make us laugh, Jason.
The only ones that I would say I didn't mind and were added in after the fact were 7 Zark 7 and Blurp, or whatever he's called.
One Rover One
for Battle of the Planets.
Yeah,
there
was a
good
of a
reason for them to be there. And their antics weren't exactly, you know, ridiculous.
Or well animated.
No, but, you know, thankfully they couldn't animate, you know, the dog accidentally wetting the floor or something.
The delightful voice of Alan Young might have helped.
Alan Young, yes, Mr. Ed Alan Young.
Yeah, still alive.
I have
his autograph of a picture of Keop.
It's still underwater.
Yes.
He's still stuck on that face.
Senator Neptune's like all rusty and
he's just waiting for it. He's like that Japanese soldier that finally was told, you know, 60 years later that the war, it really is over. Yeah. He's down there thinking there's still going to be giant monsters. And
Yep. Spectra.
Still plugging away.
Mm-hmm.
His
Tiny's funeral. He doesn't know.
And then Filmation, we should bring it right up to here and then kind of bring it to a close.
Yeah, we're going to have to do this in many parts so we keep it going.
Because then Filmation comes along, and I don't know all the details, and we should, you know, learn up on this, do some learning before the next episode, because they burst onto the scene with the biggest thing they've ever had, which is He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Oh, yeah. We've got a lot more, though. We got Isis and Arc 2 and New Adventures of Batman with Batmite, your favorite.
Jason of Star Command.
The Space Sentinels, Space Academy.
Space Breakfast Nook.
I can do a whole half an hour on Super Stretch and Micro Woman.
I'll bet you could.
And Web Woman. You
bet. You know what? That's what they've said.
Yes, that's what they said. And then we would lead up to the Brown Hornet, Flash Gordon. Yeah, there's going to be a whole heck of a lot more. You know, Filmation, Blackstar. Blackstar predates He-Man even.
Yes, so. Blackstar. I mentioned Blackstar with its whole village of imps.
Village. I got it. Trobbits is like one of those Mockbuster type movies where they, you know,
yeah, like Critters.
Well, you know what I'm talking about, like when they make a Transformers movie, and then these guys for $11 make a movie called Transmorphers.
Yes. That's exactly what it is.
Just before we...
The whole family of them.
Yes, Trobbits. And we can get into why we hate each and every one of them in the next show. Before we depart, we got a bit of cool viewer mail.
Oh, yeah.
And this was from your pal and mine, Frank Supiat, who was with Super 7.
Stop it. Oh, yeah.
And he wrote to talk about the Gerry Anderson show because he had never checked out UFO before.
Oh, okay.
And he had given me a couple of pieces of trivia, and one of them I knew, and one of them I didn't, and I wanted to share this because this is really cool. There is a certain New Jersey-based musician whose original stage name was Rob Straker.
Okay.
To emulate the Shadow Commander Ed Bishop played, named Ed Straker.
Ed Straker, yeah.
Yeah. He later changed it to Rob Zombie.
No.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
That is really cool. And you know,
That's
UFO
cool.
was really heavily reran in New Jersey area in the '70s, so that makes a lot of sense.
That's
So
cool. That's just
thanks.
cool to know that a guy like that is I know he's into the horror stuff, but it's cool to know he's into stuff like that too.
Yeah, that did me good to hear, and thanks, Frank, for dropping that email, and don't be a stranger, man.
Yeah, thanks, Frank, for listening.
So, all right, guys. Well, that's it for this episode, and we'll be back next month, probably sooner than later, and we'll bring more squeaky toys next time.
Sorry, the dogs have my imps are going crazy here. I'm trying to get them to shut up.
That's kind of funny that you were complaining about imps and you got two squeaky ones.
I'm gonna go beat some imps right now. They're going a little nuts.
All right. Well, thanks for listening as always, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care.